An afterword from Nathan Lowell. Hello, everybody, and thanks for your support. Several people have asked for more information from me. Typically, in my audiobook files, I don't like to add stuff that's not in the story. I know there's a precedent with book jackets and all, but I just had trouble doing it with a kind of Scott Sigler-esque jibber-jab kind of addition to the story itself. On the one hand, that makes my stories pretty much all story, and on the other hand, there's a connection with the people who are listening that I want to honor. So, an afterword. I've had a post over at Trader's Diary, www.durandus.org/golden, for weeks now, asking questions that you wanted answers to. I'll answer them as best I can, and I confess some of them took me by surprise. From Jay, how did you come up with the idea of the Trader's Diary? Well, the diary is just a place where I could collect the writings about the books. I wanted a place where I could put all the background materials that I'd created in the process of writing the books, and at one point, I had the aspiration of making really the Ishmael Wang's online diary, but I got busy writing, and other people were doing it by then, and it just felt kind of cheesy, so I let it go by the wayside. I figured that if I'm going to make stuff up, I may as well write it in a chapter. Merrill wrote several questions. Are there stories behind the names of the stations? Yes. NIAL is actually an acronym for Not in Our Lifetimes, which is what the original settlers thought about whether or not they'd find a habitable planet. Bink is because I needed a system I could just bink over to and back. And Umber, that's a typo. It was supposed to be Umbra, as in shadow. I had more fun with the names of the ships and the history. If you read the brief history of the Great Diaspora, you might notice that the author is a windbag. Being PhD myself, I couldn't resist the dig at academic writing. The T.A. Burleson is actually a dear friend who's provided a great deal of support. She and her husband, a shipmate, who continue to be some of the first test listeners for each episode. They checked my reality on more than one occasion. Careful listeners will notice that one of the more belligerent characters is crew on the S.C. Scott Sigler, and there are other nods to J.C. Hutchins, Matthew Wayne Selznick, and others from the Podiobook family. Merrill also asked, do you know about this universe in which the story takes place? There are company worlds which sound unpleasant. Ishmael has no safety net until he gets aboard the Lois. Yeah. Company worlds are supposed to sound unpleasant. Mostly they're not any more unpleasant than any other one-employer locale, but these are not, generally speaking, nice places to live and pursue your life, liberty, and happiness. Merrill also asked, a piece that's hanging out there for me is his father. It sounds totally plausible to me that Ishmael could encounter him somewhere. Me too, Merrill. Me too. And last from Merrill, has this story been in your head a while, or did it pop out like Athena from Zeus's head, fully formed? Well, it was hardly fully formed. I had the idea that I wanted to write a story about a common guy, just somebody who didn't have a rich father, massive muscles, or a lot of smarts. Just a guy. And I wanted to see if I could write a science fiction story from the perspective of the crew. Kind of like, what would the infamous red-shirted crewman's story have been on Star Trek, right up to the point where he gets tapped for the away team? And I wanted to write about money. Turning a profit, making your living in the universe. The common people idea. So on January 12, 2007, I sat down with the opening line in my head and just kept writing until I ran out of steam in March. I just watched the story play out in my head and tried to type fast enough to keep up. Sometimes they'd throw in a porn reel to keep me on my toes, but mostly it was not exactly stream of conscious, but more like that than painstakingly selecting each word for nuance and meaning. The three books came very fast. Lar asked, are there intelligent non-humans in the world of the Golden Age? I got the impression that the company worlds were terraformed, but still, any other intelligent life out there? There haven't been any so far, and I wouldn't rule it out. I'm not sure there's intelligent life down here, so it might be refreshing to find some. Rich asked, will Sarah progress in her role as Lois's shaman? Since she's mostly out of the story now, I'd love to know. The idea of shaman is an interesting one, and I'm not sure why I threw it in, but the more I wrote, the better I liked it, like the puka. I'm writing Sarah's backstory now in South Coast Shaman, although I may have to make it into two books because I'm having too much fun writing about her father. She will undoubtedly become a power on the ship. She's a woman of strength, intelligence, ethics, and spirit. Her story might come back later. Is the Academy on a station, or is it planetside? Also from Rich. Numar is a system. Numar Orbital is a station, and there are some Academy facilities on the station. But the majority of the Academy is located in the town of Port Numar, on the planet of Numar. Rich also asked, even though Lois is done with Ish, I've got the feeling that Ish is not done with Lois. Will he have the chance to do something for Lois in the future? I wouldn't rule anything out, but Ishmael lives in a pay-it-forward universe. My sense is that anything he does for Lois will involve helping somebody the way Lois helped him. Rich gets down to the tough questions at last with, the only thing I have yet to see in your story is an outward protagonist. Will Ish have some sort of rival to face at the Academy? I'd be happy either way, just curious. Well, the interesting thing is whether or not he'll see the antagonist. The problem with the first-person point of view is that, as reader, you can only see what the character sees. You didn't see the antagonists in these three novels because Ishmael didn't see them. You didn't see the engineering crewman who thought Ishmael was just too full of himself and spread lies and gossip about him all over the ship. You didn't see any of the petty backbiting and squabbling that happens on board ship. It was a very pleasant Pollyanna sort of experience because Ishmael didn't see it. And because of that, I couldn't write it. So, yeah, he'll probably continue to have detractors, obstructors, and even enemies the higher he goes in his chain of command. And the interesting question to me is how long before he starts to see them as that? Last he asked this. I'm also wondering what Sarah was sorting out in her head after she realized her bunk used to be Ish's. Very unimportant to the story, but I can't help wonder. Well, if I remember correctly, she was sorting out what it was he'd said about the person who had had the bunk before her, because she wanted to know how much credence to put in the stories he told her. She's actually trying to figure out how much to trust him. Router Explorer picks up on the theme of hero and antagonist. My question is a repeat from an earlier post. Ish is a good guy, no doubt, and part of the fun in the series is watching him grow and learn and succeed. It's almost like having an RPG in audio format. Your character, Ish, acquires new skills and comrades, and even new clothes and armor. It's great. However, as I bemoaned before, Ish often does this, one, because of the assistance, sometimes the unknown assistance, of his friends and or officers, and, two, through no great feats of his own. His actions are natural and automatic, and he rarely tries to do anything, he merely does. Perhaps a protagonist could help, but that doesn't seem to fit into the cosmos you've created, unless indeed we meet up with his estranged father and the conflict there is useful. My questions are, how can Ish be a hero in the classical sense when he never overcomes obstacles that actually test him? Do you have any hardships planned for Ish? Is the transformation from Ish the child to Ish the man merely climbing a comfortable ladder of promotion, or will we see Ish suffer to grow? Okay, this is a fair question, and my perspective on it is still that he does face obstacles that test him. But because the story is not so much about him as it is him, the obstacles don't have big signs on them that say, hey, buddy, over here, I'm an obstacle, any more than yours do. You get up in the morning, you solve problems all day, with any luck, and at the end of the day, you go to bed. Did you do something heroic today? Did you overcome some ridiculous odds? How would you know? What part of your eyes looking out on the world experience highlights the heroic from the, oh yeah, and today I had to slay a dragon moment? Moreover, when you tell somebody about them, do you tell them what a big damn hero you are, or do you just tell them what happened? In the saga of every man's and every woman's every day, what's heroic? Feeding your kids? Paying the rent? Winning the heart and hand of a partner? Now my question back is, how can we overlook the heroism of the everyday person who gets up, does the needful, keeps moving upward, forward, and when cut, hurt, and otherwise abused, doesn't withdraw? That's why he's a hero to me. Your mileage may vary. And an unrelated question. Obviously, this is a bit of homage to Horatio Hornblower. How often do you think refer to those stories as you write these? Is Ish's advancement intentionally correlated to that of Hornblower's? Oh, I think of them a lot. It's been decades since I read Forrester, but the stories were great. I think of them a lot because Ish is kind of an anti-Horatio. He's so far from guns and blood and glory that it's not funny, but yeah, I think of it a lot. Book Rat. Two questions for you. As somebody mentioned earlier, Ish did not seem to encounter much hardship beyond the initial tragedy that started the story, and he himself seemed to be almost superhuman. He was a teacher's pet, a ladies' man, a near genius, and an excellent physical specimen, not to mention incredibly humble, perceptive, lucky, and just plain nice. So, one question is, why did you make him so nearly perfect? I agree that he needs obstacles that really test him, that pry open a chink in that near flawless armor, both to make him a true hero and to make the story more interesting. Well, Book Rat, I'll go back to that first-person point of view thing again. You never see your own flaws. He has several, which are trotted out on a regular basis. He's an arrogant bastard. Arrogant as only a youthful male can be. Everything revolves around him, and he's always right, even when he's not. And contrary to what people have said, he's not always right. Mostly it reveals itself as things that he thought were one way actually went something else. And yeah, he does have some skills and talents, and yes, he was a mama's boy, and he's amazingly stupid about the ship, and the people on it, and the universe that surrounds it. He sees his successes. He doesn't see his failures. That's a flaw. Bookrat goes on to ask, why did you have Ish end up with Bev and only Bev? I felt bad for Brill and Diane. He did have three nights in port at the end, didn't he? I had the feeling that he never really made a choice among them, that he would have been happy with whoever showed up in his room, and that if they'd traded him off for the last few nights, he wouldn't have cared a bit. Claire IT asked a similar question with, you made it clear that Ish favored Bev when he imagined her in the little flying living room and tried to imagine how to fit Pip and Brill in there. And it was clear how much Bev cared about Ish, but why did Ish favor Bev over Brill and Diane? Well, yeah, funny. At one point, there was a version of Double Share that was, if not exactly pornographic, at least much more freewheeling than anything I had written so far. In that one, Ish found Brill in his bed, and then was traded off to Bev. And they were then joined by Brill, and the trip to Numar's system on the Bad Penny was way more than I wanted to deal with. In the end, it seemed just too much testosterone and not enough reality. In the first place, Diane, for all that she liked and even loved Ishmael, was actually in love with Francis. When Francis left the ship, Diane was on the rebound, but not ready to take up with even a cute little stud muffin like Ishmael. In the case of Brill, remember that Brill was a lot older, and would be finishing the academy years ahead of Ishmael. There really was no future for them. They both knew it. As much as he loved and admired her, and as much as she was touched and flattered by his attention, that was a relationship that never was going to go anywhere. Bev was always the love interest, from the get-go. Claire IT also asked about the death of Ish's mother. Was it really a flitter accident? The crewman who was left behind on Neris got a job that could have been given to Ish because it didn't require a lot of skill. Did the company want to get rid of Ish because of what he'd been doing with his mother's computer? That is, by getting rid of his mother, could they get rid of Ish the hacker? As far as I know, at the moment, it was only an accident. The crewman who was left behind had experience working in the galley. That experience Ishmael didn't have. That's why he got the job that Ishmael didn't. There was some speculation over the data cubes that Pip was trading, but it was just speculation. I'm sure there wasn't anything there. Really. Nothing. Nully Null asked these two really interesting questions. Will Lois ever use those sludge cakes for mushrooms? I doubt it, unless they can find a space on the ship to set up the mushroom farm. It was one of those things that Ishmael thought about but didn't really get to do anything with. The book is full of them as he goes about exploring the universe and taking us along. I wouldn't be surprised if that knowledge doesn't come back later, but the Lois lacks the open space needed to make it work. What kind of Welky would come to you?
I don't know. Perhaps a Kestrel. The thing about Welkies is that they come to you at a time of need. So if one were to come to me, it would be a signal that I needed something. And that Welky would signal what that need would be. So, I don't know.
Vess, among many others, asked this really popular question. My understanding from Book 1, that Pip was not allowing himself to be noticed too much because he was a descendant of an indie trader family, and corporate employees frown on him. Then in the third book, it turns out that pretty much everyone, including most of the crew of a corporate ship like the Lois, is part of an indie trader family. How do we put those two together? What am I missing? I spent the last third of full share racking my brain, but got nothing.
This is one of those ideas that I never expected was going to be such a big thing, but has been asked more than any other question. The bottom line problem is that everybody is assuming that Pip is correct in his assumption that everybody hates indies. This is fostered by only being able to see through Ishmael's eyes and from the example of his treatment on the Duchamp. Pip is also overly defensive. It's that defensiveness that got him into trouble on the Duchamp, not his trading. He's also wrong, but it's what he believes when he tells it to Ishmael. In fact, Pip is wrong and comes to realize it in his time on the Lois, but as reader, you can't see that because it's in Pip's head, not in Ishmael's, and it never really comes up again. How many of us follow up on the misguided beliefs of our youth and track down the people later to say, "Oh yeah, remember when I told you that? I was full of crap." It doesn't happen. That was it for questions for this afterword. Thank you again to everybody who's listened, downloaded, subscribed, and rated the titles on patiobooks.com. Your enthusiasm and support have kept me writing much longer than I would have thought possible. Your donations are very gratefully received and have purchased the preamp and microphones with which I've recorded Half Share and Full Share. Last, South Coast Shaman is coming. The first draft should be done this weekend, and I'll have a few days to polish it up before I start recording. My goal is to have it all on Patio Books by January 11th. If I make it, that'll be 4 books, written, recorded, and published in audio in 1 year. Thank you all for listening, and safe voyage.